Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Elizabeth Sobel, the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. Since its opening 50 years ago, the Saratoga Performing Arts Center has been recognized as a vital cultural hub of upstate New York, the Hudson Valley, Vermont, the Berkshires, Connecticut, and nearby Canada. You can find out more at www.spac.org. Widely revered for her bright intellect and compelling programming instincts, Elizabeth Sobel brings to SPAC diverse experience and a determination to bring great music and dance in all its guises to SPAC audiences. Before coming to SPAC, Sobel most recently served as president and CEO of Universal Music Classics, UMC, where she successfully ran the American home for the prestigious Decca, Deutsche Grammophon, Mercury Classics, and ECM imprints, along with the revitalized UMC label, which Sobel oversaw from Universal's New York headquarters. Soon after joining UMC, Sobel led the company to the number one spot on Billboard's classical traditional label chart in 2014 and 15. Sobel created the IMG Artist Dance Division, which grew into the most prestigious roster of dance clients in the industry, representing the Bolshoi Ballet, the Bilty Jones Arne Zane Dance Company, Palabolas, Le Ballet, Trocaderos de Monte Carlo, Lyon Opera Ballet, and Miami City Ballet. Sobel also created and oversaw IMGA's initiatives and growth in the area of world music, jazz, contemporary music, and music dance theatricals. From 2006 to 12, Sobel was programmer and producer of the Festival of the Arts Boca, which included many of IMGA's premier clients as well as cultural figures such as Salman Rushdie, Edward Albee, David Brooks, and Doris Kearns Goodwin. In the recording sphere, Sobel has been executive producer of numerous albums, three of which have garnered Grammy nominations. Sobel studied at Sarah Lawrence College and the Rotterdam Conservatory. She received her Bachelor in Music and Piano Performance from the North Carolina School of the Arts. We'll talk with Elizabeth Sobel about all of this and much more, but first, welcome new SPAC CEO Elizabeth Sobel.
Hi there. Thanks for bringing me onto your great program today, Alan.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. Elizabeth, let's start, because I always like to do this. We're learning a little something about the person. Where were you born?
Kannapolis, with a K, North Carolina.
Kannapolis?
Yes.
Do they have Navy ships there?
No. They did not. It was landlocked. It was a tiny little place next to Charlotte, North Carolina, and it was a mill town. And Kannapolis supposedly came from... It somehow, in some language, meant City of Looms, which I think was not correct, but that was the legend that attended to that name.
And so what did your folks do?
My grandparents, who all had basically second grade educations, worked in the mills.
Right.
And my father was the first to go to college from his family. He became an attorney. And my mom, also the first to go to college from her family, was an aspiring musician. And my dad ultimately became very involved in civil rights in the day. And, you know, I, as an avid reader, thought that my father was Atticus Finch.
And was he?
He was very involved in civil rights at
the
time.
So he was courageous.
He was courageous indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Were there ever threats to the family?
Yes, many.
Can you tell us about one of them?
Gosh, so in those days, there was no internet chatter because there was no internet.
Certainly.
But where the law enforcement would pick up threats was over on CB radio. And so they would hear that somebody was out to come look for my dad, and they would send a car over to pick us up and take us out of our house.
Wow.
Yeah.
And siblings?
One sister, 8 years younger.
Wow.
Yeah.
And your mom, did she have a job?
My mom was such a fascinating, incredible, I shouldn't say was, she is a fascinating, amazing woman who also grew up in Kannapolis with a great desire to be a musician, and she sang and played the flute. When I was growing up in that Atticus Finch period, she became very involved in yoga and became a yoga instructor, which was equally courageous at that time in that place.
In North Carolina.
In North Carolina, yeah. At that time, people didn't really distinguish between yoga and yogurt, so.
I still have a problem with that one. So I guess the fascination with music was passed on to you because you became sort of a piano prodigy.
Thank you for using the word prodigy. So, you know, when I look back on why did I end up and how did I end up doing what I did, I think the really seminal moments happened on my mother's mother, one of the four mill workers in my family. I was a young child, and she would hold me in her arms in the front porch swing on warm evenings in North Carolina with the, you know, very incredibly evocative smells of, you know, flowering plants in the air. And she would sing to me. She would sing songs. She would tell me stories. And I think that really fueled my lifelong love affair with words and music.
What were some of the songs? Were they folk songs or were they
foreign songs? I don't even remember what they were.
Right.
I think they were more folk and more ditties and things like that. My grandmother was one of 13 children, and they lived on a farm. And her great ambition would have been to sing operetta. And so I remember her telling me these stories, how she wanted to sing an operetta. I don't know where that came from, and I wasn't old enough to have thought to ask her at the time, but...
Well, the movies of the time did a lot with operettas.
Yeah.
Because I watched the old movie channel, so I know that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so you started to play the piano. At what age?
So I started to play the piano at age 6, and I'll tell you why I ended up playing the piano, because my parents believed in a child having some sort of artistic training, and they gave me the option to be either a dance student to go take ballet or to play the piano. And being that I was a tomboy, because if my father was Atticus Finch, then I, by logic, was Scout.
Certainly.
So I was a big tomboy, and the idea of having to appear in front of people in a tutu was so abhorrent to me at the age of 6 that I chose the piano.
So your mother was the flute player. Did she play flute with you while you were playing piano?
No, but she did sing, and my mother and father both loved musical theater, and so I would accompany her while she sang, you know, things from Sound of Music or Oliver. Those were kind of the big hits in our family at that
time.
Yeah,
I forget how old I am, so those things seem so relatively recent to me. Okay, so you're playing the piano. Did you want to go and concertize?
So I'm not sure I was really that conscious of what I wanted to do with it at that age. But what I did know is that I wanted to get the heck out of that little town.
Yeah.
Because even at that young age, I sensed that there was another way to live life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became obsessed with going to the North Carolina School of the Arts, which was, I think at the time, the first state-funded conservatory.
And that was Charlotte?
That was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And so when I was 12, I began practicing very, very hard so as to nail the auditions to get in. And I did finally get accepted to the School of the Arts and went off at age 13 and never looked back.
And you said finally. Did you have frustrations along the way?
So what happened to me was, being that I was a tomboy, I was also playing a lot of sports, and at that point, particularly tennis, and I had some really bad wrist pain and went to a doctor, and the doctor said, you're playing a lot of tennis and you're practicing the piano a lot, and now you're at a place where you've got to choose.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I chose
piano.
The piano, but I remember at the time having dreams where I was out on a stage playing the piano and Arthur Ashe would come out. And this is dating me, but Arthur Ashe would come out.
Not dating
out.
You, dating
he
me.
He was not dating.
Arthur Ashe was yesterday as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, Arthur Ashe, operetta, shall we talk about the telegraph machine or whatever? No, but these dreams, he would come out and sort of question why I was on a stage at a piano and not out on a tennis court. So.
Right. Did you have other sports besides tennis?
Loved football. I was the quarterback on the boys' team when I was 12.
No.
Yes.
Oh, that's great. And that gave you your executive experience to begin with.
So. Yeah. I think so. And also my ability to withstand moments when, like...
Sexism.
Know, that, and also when 11 people pile on top of you without mercy.
Uh-huh,
so,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
So did you, when you were doing your quarterbacking, were you known as somebody who didn't take any bleep?
Yes, yes.
You had to develop that?
Yes, yes. I think my father was an incredibly amazing influence to me, and the way... He had an incredible ability to live in that community and be strong and courageous and yet respected and accepted in the community at large.
Just like Atticus.
Just like Atticus, yeah.
Right, right.
Exactly.
Right.
So I think I learned, You know, one of the things, I think one of the reasons I did become such a sports person was because it was my time spent with my father. So I would go, you know, I would go to him to games or even go play golf, you know, be in the golf cart with him, you know. But I also went to the courthouse a lot with him. And I, you know, I saw the behind the scenes. I saw, I heard conversations I never should have heard as a child, behind the scenes in the courtroom process. But my father was a great orator. He knew how to move people, and his closing summations like literally could bring people to tears. So I experienced firsthand the power of oratory and the power of words to change hearts.
Elizabeth Sobel, of course, is the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. So Elizabeth, before we get to the important point of the day, I always am so fascinated by these sort of character studies of what makes us who we are, you know.
Exactly. I mean,
it's so telling that you get to this spot from where you were then. At what point did you know you weren't going to be, you know, a concert pianist?
So I can pinpoint exactly the moment. I think there were already, my unconscious was becoming conscious, and I was finding myself resistant to going into the practice room and really putting in the hours I needed to put in. And I remember one day I was back at the North Carolina School of the Arts finishing my degree, and I think there was a symposium scheduled for the juniors and seniors by two people who were very influential in the arts world. One was a very well-known classical music publicist, and the other was a very well-known promoter of young classical talent. And they came down to the School of the Arts to kind of talk to kids about careers as musicians. This was long before there was such a thing as a classical music degree or arts and administration degrees and things. And I remember sitting in that assembly thinking, or looking at these two women and going, wow, those two women make their live in New York, and they make their living telling artists what to do. That's for me. And the light bulb went off. And I went to the dean of the School of Music who had organized this gathering, and I said, I think we both know I'm not going to be the next Alicia de la Rocha, so I think I know, or in fact, I know that I know what I want to do, and that's it.
And did you not go? Did you not play?
I pretty much stopped playing. I mean, for years when I was living in Park Slope in Brooklyn, I did have a piano and I would play every night before I went to bed. I haven't done that now.
Neighbors like that, did they?
Well, luckily I was in a house, so the sound wasn't an issue and I could play very late at night. I tend to be a nocturnal person and I would go to bed every night. I would play Bach preludes and fugues and occasionally try to get through the Goldberg variations when I was feeling courageous.
That's fantastic. So college?
So I had a very checkered educational past because, first of all, going to conservatory, your liberal arts or any of your training, you're very much focused on music. And then when I left the School of the Arts, I went to Sarah Lawrence for a year and loved it, but I really wanted to get back more into music. And I ended up going to Rotterdam to study with some Russian musicians whom I had met at a chamber music festival, and I went specifically to study with them.
Wow.
And then I ended up back at the School of the Arts because I just knew I wanted to get my degree done and get out into the world.
Smart.
So.
Yeah. So have you spent any time in Asheville?
My mom lives there now.
No,
I spend a lot of time there.
I want you to know I love Asheville. That's one of those places which I have decided, if I had to choose, I could retire to. But of course, I'm 75, so I probably never will get to that. But I'm, you know, I love that community.
It's an extraordinary place, totally extraordinary. I actually selfishly convinced my mom to move up there from where she was moving near where we grew up because I said, you know, I promise I'll come to visit you more if you're actually living in Asheville and not in Kannapolis and Concord.
No, it's a great place.
Yes.
So you got out of the School of the Arts.
Yep.
And then what did you do?
So that day that I said to the dean, I think we both know, well, I'm not meant to be. You know, he and some other people in the School of Music started making calls to management agencies in New York City. And one of them happened to be an agency called Hamlin Management, which was run by a gentleman named Charles Hamlin, who was a Schenectady native.
Wow.
So I remember the day I arrived to Hamlin Management. It's what we would now refer to as a startup company. And Charles Hamlin met me, an incredible man who I sat in this, it was on, in an apartment on West 85th Street in the days when West 85th Street was not a place you went if you had a choice.
It's where I grew up and I knew it well.
Okay.
So anything between 86 and 96 or 86 and 79, those off streets were, now each of those houses, homes, of course, is worth multi-millions of dollars. Yeah. But then it was rough.
It was rough. And I remember going into that basement apartment and yet feeling the sense of joy and discovery and exhilaration that, the kind of love for music and musicians that Charlie Hamlin had and his partner Edna Landau. And I knew I had come home. I knew that, that's what I wanted to do with people like that. But in those days, the phone would ring three times a week, and two of those would be Charlie's mother calling to see how the business was doing. And we used to joke that, like, our cash flow was basically limited to the change I came back with from the corner bodega going to get three light coffees with sugar. So
young girl, New York, challenges?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I'm sure there were many, but I don't. My memory of it is just one of discovery and exhilaration.
Put another way, and a little bit more grotesquely, were men hitting on you?
Wow. I guess so. I had a boyfriend early on, and so I think that kind of kept me out of...
Who was he?
He was a violinist who I met at Sarah Lawrence.
Oh, so, I see.
Yeah, so yeah. We were... Yeah. Honestly, I think I've repressed that whole period of my life. You're asking me very detailed questions that I don't remember very
well. We all do. Okay, so then you were at this startup, basically, agency, and you were learning about management techniques and how to handle clients, and then where'd you go from that?
So I was with them for, I want to say, 6 to 8 months. And when my internship was over, we were all very sad. I know I was devastated to be leaving.
Oh, so this was an internship.
This was an internship. And so what happened was when we parted, they said, listen, this has been incredible. We wish we had the money to hire you, but we don't have any money right now. But if things change, we're going to stay in touch and we will stay connected. And what happened was that little startup, a year and a half later, was bought by the big sports marketing giant, IMG.
I see.
And so they called me and said, we now have money. We'd like to hire you to come be our director of sales. And so I came immediately. I was part of the launch and the beginning of that company. And then I was there for the 30 years that it went from being a David to a Goliath. And I went from being intern to managing director over the course of many, many years.
So what does that mean, being director of sales? What did you have to sell?
Artists.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you got an artist.
I was a booking agent, essentially. That was a glorified.
So you got an agent. And then how would you deal with that? You'd make calls to people, say this guy would fit in very well at the Linda Norris Auditorium or at SPAC
all
or whatever.
Of the above, all of the above. Yeah. You would get on the phone. You had lists, which in those days were probably on, you know, legal pads, you know, lists of people or on index cards, you know, the contact, the name, the history of calls that had been previously made, what they were potentially interested in. And you would just stay on them and be in touch on a regular basis and send them reviews when the artists performed and got great reviews. And
what were the questions? Can you get us an audience? Will this person attract an audience?
It's funny you say that. Those were not questions that got asked in those days.
Uh-huh.
And it's quite telling. It's a really, really good point. Because in those days, to be honest, classical music was still thriving enough that a lot of presenters or promoters could afford to bring in, as long as they had some bigger artists who were guaranteed box office, whether it's like an Itzhak Perlman or Pinka Zukerman or Argerich or whoever they happen to be, they could afford to take risks on building younger artists. And so, for instance, there's this extraordinary woman out in San Francisco named Ruth Felt, who ran San Francisco Performances. And she was one of the all-time greats at, like, hearing a young artist and saying, that young artist needs to be heard in our city. And so she would invite them, knowing she might sell 100 tickets the first time they came out. But that was okay. She would introduce them to her subscribers, to the community at large, and then she'd bring them back a second time and maybe they'd do 300 tickets or 500 tickets, and she was willing to invest in them over the course of many years. And that's how the business used to work in those days. It doesn't work that way anymore.
Now, how does it work?
Well, so first of all, the ecosystem for classical music has changed substantially over the years, and people don't have the same ability to invest long term to take those risks. And so what tends to happen is, you know, there's a handful of classical music superstars who are pretty much guaranteed box office, and they book those artists, and then they'll look for the younger artists who have already like a strong social media following or a good publicist, or, you know, they'll go with artists who are excellent musically and artistically, but who also have kind of their own following.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's a different mechanism, different criteria to a certain degree, but it has to be within a much shorter time frame. It can't be that kind of long build.
Are you married?
Yes.
When did that happen?
2002.
I can't do it either. And I get really get into big trouble for this.
Oh, I can never remember dates. But my husband is actually, I got very involved in Cuban music and Latin music many, many years ago. An interesting story, if you don't mind a slight detour.
On the contrary.
I was on the road. Itzhak Perlman was one of my management clients, you know, in the day when I was working at IMG. And I went out on the road with him. He did you might remember this. He did a recording called In the Fiddler's House, which is homage to klezmer music.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, nobody knew what klezmer music was. Now there's this whole resurgence younger people doing klezmer, but nobody knew. The public at large didn't know what klezmer music was. And so Itzhak did an amazing recording, and there was a fantastic PBS special done on it. And so it became so popular, there was kind of popular demand for this to go out on the road as a concert.
Uh-huh.
And so I produced that tour, and we went all over the United States. And the very first tour, so I was out on the road with Itzhak and 25 klezmer musicians from three different bands.
Did he bring his wife?
No, his wife, they had fairly young children at the time. So
what's the wife's name?
Toby Perlman.
Yes,
so
I grew
lovely.
Up with her on Fire Island.
You're kidding.
No, but go ahead.
Oh, my God. A lovely person, so dedicated to education and classical music.
Yeah.
So we were out on the road, and the last concert on the tour was in Mexico City. And by the time we got to Mexico City, I was pretty exhausted because I was out on the road as kind of manager, tour manager, all around, do whatever needed to be done. The promoters of the show ended up taking me out to a club in Polanco that night where I heard live Cuban music for the first time.
Ah.
And I had an epiphany. The music completely somehow inhabited my being. And so I went back to New York 2 days later, determined to learn to speak Spanish, learn to dance salsa, and learn to play Afro-Cuban percussion. And I did all of those things. Then it led me to, 3 years later, I met my husband, who is a fairly well-known Cuban jazz, Afro-Cuban music performer.
And where did he grow up?
In Havana.
No kidding.
Yeah. His name is Jorge Gomez, and he has a spectacular band called Tiempo Libre, who are a multi-Grammy nominated band playing Cuban music.
So how did the courtship evolve?
Oh, God. You're really making me bare all, aren't you?
Yes.
I was representing a, at that time, very famous Cuban artist who was living in Miami. Her name was Albita. If you have never heard her, you should listen to her. She's an extraordinary singer. But she had a habit of changing band musicians and music directors on a fairly regular basis. And they were on their way up to New York to play a week at the Blue Note when she decided to let go of her whole band. And her personal manager called me in a panic saying, could you please find a way for Albita to have a run through with the new band on her way to New York? And just by complete fluke, I knew the then in-between owner of the Stone Pony in Asbury Park, New Jersey, who did me a favor and booked the band, booked Albita with her new band on the, I think, Saturday night before the Monday that they were arriving.
Okay, but just in terms of the progress line, where were you in your career? What were you doing at that moment?
I was the associate director at IMG Artists.
Right.
I represented a lot of clients, and, you know, people like Itzhak Perlman and Joshua Bell and a lot of the, you know, big classical
no
clients.
No wonder they hired you.
But then I was also like smitten with this Latin music bug. And so the night I went to hear Albita, to hear the new band with you know, with the new music director, the person, captivating person who walked out and sat down at the keyboards and proceeded to, let's just say, wow me.
Now, do we know why he hired her, why she hired him, as opposed to, was she interested in him or no?
No, definitely not.
Wasn't that, yeah.
No, wasn't that. No, he's an extraordinary pianist. I think people, even... I obviously have a subjective opinion that I'd like to feel is also objective from my professional view, but he was just known as a charismatic, magnetic, over-the-top, exuberant pianist.
So when did he notice you and you notice him?
That night when we danced together after the show was over.
You already knew how to salsa and all that, yeah. Right? Yes.
Yeah, I do believe in fate, and had I not... learn to speak Spanish and learn to dance salsa, that night would have never happened.
How did you learn to speak Spanish?
Okay, so I haven't explicitly said this implicitly. I'm a fanatical book person, and I'm a great poetry lover, and I had on my shelves of books in my Park Slope apartment many books of bilingual editions of Neruda and Borges and whatever. So when I came back from that trip to Mexico and knew I wanted to learn to speak Spanish, I got down a book of Neruda poetry that was bilingual, and I started reading the English and then reading the Spanish and reading the English, and kind of, it was a really great way to start learning the language. And
have
then
you seen the new Neruda moving picture?
What, the Il Postino? Wait, what's it called?
Yeah, no, Il Postino was one of his things, but uh-huh. There's a full-length biography.
No,
yes,
I didn't
it's a
know
dramatized
that.
Biography. Very interesting.
Oh, I have to watch
sorry,
that. I'm a huge Neruda fan.
Yeah, okay, so.
So that's how it started. And ultimately, I realized at a certain point I was going to have to get my head out of the books and really start studying with a teacher who could correct me and I could speak with. And a couple of people in the music business recommended a woman named Josefina Montes, an Argentinian woman. I went to her apartment on West 45th Street and a 5-story walk up and went into her. She was a very elegant, formal woman who had a wicked sense of humor. And I went and sat down at the chair, and she was across the desk, and on the wall behind her were photographs of Buñuel and Borges and Neruda and Fuentes, all the photographs of all my idols. So I knew from that day that we were going to get along well. And she, when she found out what a literature fanatic I was, she kind of taught me through literature as opposed to, you know, your usual kind of grammar and exercises.
That's interesting. That's how I learned to speak French as well as I do it now.
Really?
Yeah, no, I read The Little Prince.
Uh-huh. So. That's what they called you, right? The Little Prince?
No, they didn't. But in any case, we got through. So now you're learning Spanish and you become fluent. Do you think that there's a relationship between your dexterity as a pianist and your ability to learn language?
Such an interesting question. Here's what's fascinating about that. When I was younger and I was in school, I studied French and I studied German, and none of it stuck.
Mm.
And so
I get it.
Much later, I think that there was a different... I think when you're studying something and you're trying to learn it from the left brain, it doesn't stick as well. Whereas if you've got something like... I look at that whole experience in Mexico as Eros with a capital E, meaning sort of, you know, a connection with something beyond, a kind of connection with all those impulses inside us that, you know, that are transformational around language and art and dance and music and movement.
Now, remind us of the Mexican experience again.
So when I heard Cuban music for the first time, oh, actually, I didn't get to that point.
Yes, I thought so. So that's why I asked the question as gently as I could.
All right. So sorry. So I was in Mexico with Itzhak Perlman. I was taken out to this club where I heard live Cuban music for the first time. I refer to it as my epiphany because I had this kind of full being need to embrace, to learn Spanish, to learn to dance salsa, to learn Afro-Cuban percussion, because the effect on my being of that music was so profound that I was trying to understand it. It was something that defied logic, what had happened to me. It's interesting. And then to go back to your point, I actually found it easier to learn a language. I learned it very quickly and surprisingly quickly.
Living there.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, you know, Alistair Reed was one of the great, great translators from Spanish to English. And he translated a lot of Neruda and Borges, all of those greats. And I had the great privilege to spend time with him during this time when I was, you know, this encounter with Spanish language. And I began to find that I loved the process of translation. And he actually mentored me. He would read my translations and work with me and actually helped me get to some people about working as a translator at one point. But we had this conversation about what happens to the brain and the being when you learn a new language, and how it literally, obviously it's changing those neuronal pathways, but it changes something in the being. I'm a different person for having learned Spanish and learned to dance salsa and learned to play Afro-Cuban percussion.
You are so bright. Does it ever tick you off when pretentious people walk around who went to Harvard? You know, and sort of look down their noses sometime.
You mean a mill worker girl who didn't get a good education?
And you know, you know what you've done and how smart you are and all the rest of it. Okay, I'm done with that now. So I guess the next question, we'll try to earn some money here, and we'll get to SPAC.
Okay.
What happened between your incredible career at one agency? How did it happen that you came to SPAC?
Okay, let me think how to do this.
And while you're thinking,
succinctly.
I want to remind everybody we're listening to Elizabeth Sobel, the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. Okay, Elizabeth, you're on.
Okay, let me try to do this very succinctly because there's a lot to this story. First of all, I had gone from IMG Artists to Universal Music Classics. So I went from the management side to the recorded music side, obviously during a time when there are many, many challenges in recorded music. So,
like nobody buys CDs anymore.
Yes, that's the biggest challenge. But also an erosion of society's interest in classical music as an art form, which is something we all are contending with and something that we're focusing very much at SPAC, which we'll get to. But after 3 years at Universal, I just decided that I no longer wanted to do the corporate battles internally that are required when you're in a commercial organization, a commercial institution, defending and advocating for great art, right? And so what I really had planned to do when I left in April was take the whole summer off and really think about what I wanted to do. I'd never, from that faded time when I went up for my internship in, New York City on West 85th Street to April of 2016, I'd never taken a break. And so I really felt like I wanted some time for self-reflection and really think about what the next step was going to be. So I was in our Miami Beach apartment. Well, that's a whole other long story, but our residence, Jorge and my residence.
Miami, the Spanish capital of the world.
Correct.
People don't know it. It ain't your granny's Miami
anymore.
Oh,
my God. Literally, my husband and I speak Spanish at home, and if I didn't have to do work, I could go weeks at a time without speaking a word of English where we live and, where our residence is in Miami Beach. And so after I had walked out the door at Universal, I literally was at home for 5 days when I got a call from a search firm saying, by the way, we're conducting the search for the new president of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, and a number of people have recommended you for the job. So we wanted to talk to you about it. And I said, with probably more than a hint of sarcasm in my voice, let me walk over to my window and describe to you what I'm looking at out the window. And then you tell me why I should consider moving to Saratoga Springs, New York. And they proceeded to tell me why. And I have to say they did an incredible job at really conveying the enchantments and the cultural vibrancy of Saratoga and the capital region to me in a way that I was finally willing to say, okay, sure, let me throw my hat into the ring. And then when I came up here for the first interview, I went out for a walk on the Sunday evening before the Monday interview and meandered downtown not knowing anything about downtown Saratoga, and happened to meander by Lyrical Ballad and North Shire Books, and said to myself, what city of this size, or in fact of any size, has two such extraordinary bookstores within 4 blocks of each other? So I was kind of mesmerized. I thought, being someplace where you walk downtown and be in either of those bookstores in 5 minutes was immediately very attractive to me. And then I, the next day, met with the search committee, which included, a number of board members on it. And counter to, the stories one often hears of, not-for-profit boards and the arts, what I encountered was a group of the most extraordinary, open, passionate people who are so dedicated to a community and to the place of Saratoga Performing Arts Center in this area. And I was utterly disarmed and, again, enchanted by what I saw.
Are you going to bring any change to SPAC?
I would call it more enhancement and building on than change per se. I'll tell you what I see. It's funny that you mentioned Asheville, because having spent a lot of time in Asheville, one of the things I was contemplating, I'm a huge nature lover, and Asheville is just spectacular that way.
It truly is.
It's truly spectacular, and the way it melds art and culture and food.
With the Blue Ridge Mountains.
With the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's one of the great, you know, spiritual, cultural nexus, and, you know, whatever the plural of nexus is, in the world. It's so special. So I had actually been thinking, I was sitting at a lake in Black Mountain and thinking about all the history of Black Mountain and everything, thinking, gosh, I wonder if there's something I could do here that would bring together art and culture in a way. If you think about the enormous tradition of how nature has inspired art since, you know, cave paintings. And I was really pondering that, and might that be a direction I would go in. And I was even contemplating moving to Asheville itself, because I was so enchanted with the city. So at any rate, I'm a Southerner, so I tend to have a very circular way of answering your question. So the changes or the enhancements, one will have to do with the way I see the center coming in from outside and what I think its unique qualities are. Obviously, what happens on the stage is extraordinary. The level of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York City Ballet and Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, it doesn't get any better than that. But you could argue that you can see all of those artists on other stages in places outside the capital region, mainly in their homes of New York and Philadelphia. So what will make somebody from outside Saratoga or outside the capital region want to come up here? And that, to me, is this unique and unparalleled marriage of man-made beauty and natural beauty that one has, not just at SPAC, but in the Spa State Park. And so we're playing a lot just in terms of rebranding ourselves, not just as ballerinas on the stage and great musicians on the stage, but as this kind of holistic experience, an immersive experience of beauty, of all kinds of beauty.
How do you do it?
Well, for one thing, we are going to be just the whole imagery around, I mean, the rebranding, I mean, how we message out to people, that it will no longer just be like a photograph of, you know, a great conductor or a great ballerina. It will be a more immersive, inclusive kind of imagery that includes the natural beauty. That's obviously easier said than done, but we're very deep into a process of questioning and strategizing about how we're going to do that. But it also is going to have to, getting to, you know, sort of another enhancement is the way we do programming. And so one of the things that I'm planning to do that we're already in the process of doing is creating events that are in addition to what happens on the amphitheater stage, to create performances and programming and art encounter with arts on those beautiful, exquisite parklands, you know, whether it's in the woods or around the reflecting pool or in and around. So we want people to have encounters with art nestled in the beauty of nature. And so that's going to be a big part of what we're doing.
That's great. I'm sure you all want to know who we've been talking to, a wonderful, wonderful person, Elizabeth Sobel, the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. So, Elizabeth, so when you were telling me before, in your previous life, you knew all these people, Joshua Bell, all of the rest of these guys. Will that help you in terms of your job and attracting them, or is that all done outside? Is that all just sort of contractual?
No, I think that, look, most of the artists that I worked with, certainly at that level, were already regular visitors to Saratoga.
Sure.
I think one place where, you know, I think one of the most popular and like by far the concert that people talk about the most from last summer, this past summer, was the Joshua Bell Chris Botti evening. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having an inside track on different projects and, you know, I think may help us, you know about things that are happening earlier on, so we can make sure that they come via SPAC when they're out on the road. And down the road, what I'm very much hoping to do is commission new works and be a producer of new projects.
Well, that costs a lot of money. Where do you get all that money from?
I am a firm believer that when you've got something exciting, I think there's a great thirst in this area, and I've talked to people a lot about it, who want to be part of helping be a creative incubator and be a creative center rather than just a curatorial center. It's no longer enough to just keep putting, you know, the sort of great canon of ballet and classical music on the stage. You need the excitement and the creative energy of new work and new collaborations.
So one of the wraps on SPAC, of course, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, is that you have this job. It involves all the arts, and then there's the rock and roll. How do you balance that?
So what I would say to you is that I'm all for what, I think it was Ellington who used to say, you know, that line about what kind of music do you like, Mr. Ellington? Well, there's only great music and everything else. I like the former. And that's me. I feel like, you know, SPAC is best in class as a venue, as an amphitheater. And as long as anything that comes out on that stage, more or less, is best in class, I'm all for it. Great music is great music.
But is there a tension between, you know, the rock and roll producers, you know, who have their thing, and SPAC and your job?
I'm not sensing it. I'm all about collaboration. And so far, we have a very collaborative relationship with Live Nation. And I want that to deepen. I mean, I could see a time when we actually co-promote some events of artists who kind of span. There's a lot of artists out there who are appealing to an audience who aren't necessarily pop music fans, but they're also not yet Philadelphia Orchestra fans.
Right.
And there are a lot of audience members in that unbridged pool. And so appealing to those people is going to be a big part of my job, too, making the programming more diverse and more varied. There are a number of art forms or genres that we're not touching yet that I really feel.
For example? You
know, world music. To me, that's a very big part of representing world music of all sorts.
And a lot more Spanish music.
For sure. I'm sure you'll see some Cuban music coming up soon.
I can't wait.
And also, you know, I think there's a big opportunity, and we've already been having a lot of meetings with the SPA State Park partners. So, for instance, there's the Dance Museum, there's the Automobile Museum, there's everything that the parks are doing, everything that we're doing. And so we're having a lot of conversations about how we can create park-wide programming.
Farmers?
Yes. Well, for example, you know, I'm sure you know about Pitney Farm and what's been going on in Saratoga. Like, I'm a big, you know, because I'm such a nature person, I love the fact that the Pitney Farm thing went through. I think that's a fantastic thing for Saratoga.
Remind everybody what it is.
Well, I'm not sure. The Pitney Farm, rather, it was purchased to turn it into a continually operating farm rather than being developed for, you know, real estate, which, you know, those are important tensions to work through in a city like Saratoga. And that whole thing around, you know, planned development, you have to develop, you have to have, you know,
sure,
the right development to keep a city vibrant on the economic side, but you also need green space too, because that's exactly the kind of thing that will bring people from beyond the capital region to want to come up and spend their summers at SPAC. So I can see maybe some collaborations with Pitney Farm or other organizations really to really expose people to that idea about ecosystem, that an ecosystem, music is part of the ecosystem,
Neat.
Arts are part of the ecosystem. It all needs to be healthy. We all need to be working collaboratively together.
We are talking to Elizabeth Sobel, the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. So, Elizabeth, is there a competition between you guys and Tanglewood? I mean, you know, this colossus over there, we live near it. It's unbelievably wonderful. You guys are unbelievably wonderful. Is there a tension between the two? I mean, I've seen some of the great soloists go from Tanglewood basically to SPAC.
I don't think that there is a tension. I think we're certainly, in my own personal view, we're so very different in many ways. And it goes back to that point I made about making SPAC a destination festival. we're not the same organization, that we don't have the same type of history that Tanglewood do, nor do we have that kind of educational aspect to what they have and the history that they have. I mean, but I think that what we do have that Tanglewood does not have, you know, being located in 2,200 acres of the most spectacular parklands with such a variety of experience, the history of the city, you know, the idea of Saratoga as a healing place with its history around the waters. I've been told by experts in the waters world that the only other place in the world that has waters of the level, the quality, and the variety of Saratoga is Vichy, France. So people can come up for this kind of immersive experience, not to mention the fact that you can go from New York City to Saratoga on a train. You don't have to rent a car to get there like you do with Tanglewood. And once you're in Saratoga, you not only have the spectacular park and the spectacular Saratoga Performing Arts Center, but you have an unbelievable downtown with incredible restaurants and shops and bookstores, and you've got Yaddo and Skidmore and Universal Preservation Hall and Cafe Lena. It's a completely different experience. And I think that, again, trying to...
To say nothing of the horses.
To say nothing about the horses. And I think that's such an interesting point, because when I came up here, I knew nothing about horses, to be honest. And the other day, I went to see the racing museum, and I had no idea what to expect. And I've been on a horse once in my life. I've never been to a track, and I walked it out of that museum with the bug. And that night I went home and I Netflixed my way through Secretariat and Seabiscuit.
Both great films.
Amazing. And you know what I was thinking was, there's so many ways that we can be working collaboratively, because if you look at the emotional response to, you know, the majesty and the magic of horses, great horses, and the thrill of, you know, triumph and tragedy or everything around horse racing, there's so many emotional components that are very equivalent to what we go through listening to great music. So I feel like there's some really essential collaborative efforts that we can have sort of citywide around Saratoga too, and the capital region in general. There's so much going on in this region. I'm really blown away.
So I don't know much about the fiscal issues surrounding the festivals. And I'm wondering, is that a big part of your job, getting enough money to run the place?
Oh, gosh, yes. Mm. I would say that.
How do you do it?
You know, well, you know, Saratoga Performing Arts Center has, I'm sure, like Tanglewood, an incredible 50-year commitment. I'm amazed at how dedicated people are.
In fact, I'm looking at this, Elizabeth, this wonderful SPAC 50, the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, one of the biggest books I have ever seen with the history of Saratoga of Performing Arts in it. And yep, you are so right about that. But I interrupted. I'm sorry.
No, thank you for mentioning that, because that book is just coming out at a perfect time for me, because it's really giving me a sense, a much more deep...
It's the history
of the place, and it is extraordinary. And, you know, I think the thing that's been so amazing to me is not just this history of the people who built and performed on and who had the vision of SPAC, but virtually everybody that I come in contact with in my daily life, my work life, my personal life, and in the community, everybody I come in contact with, it has some SPAC story. They have been impacted personally by SPAC, and they have deep memories of how incredible SPAC has been in their lives. So when you talk about raising money for an organization like SPAC, I think, you know, I'm, you know, in a wonderful position in the sense that there's already tremendous loyalty and love for the organization. Now, how do we fund these new initiatives that, you know...
You have to go around and ask people for money?
Of course, yeah. I'll inspire them to want to be part of the future. That's what I'd like to look at.
Right. Well, that seems to me is one of the hardest parts to do what you do.
Yeah.
So clear you have passion when it comes to the arts. But then it comes this other side, which both you and I have to do, which is to find the money to fund
exactly
the enterprise.
Exactly.
And in that, I take it your board is going to be helpful.
They've already been unbelievably helpful. They've been just, I couldn't even begin to enumerate all the ways that they've been supportive and strategic and collegial and collaborative.
What is the relationship between a board and an executive director? If I have a book left in me That's going to be the one.
That's interesting. Well, of course, this is my first time running a not-for-profit organization.
Okay.
So I can only speak to, you know, my current experience, and that is, you know, they've hired me to do a job. And so at the end of the day, I'm going to do the job and do it in the way that I believe is correct. But with their counsel, their collaboration all along the way, I really believe in collaboration in all areas. So our staff at SPAC is an amazingly dedicated, smart, passionate team. And so we're working very collegially and collaboratively within the office. As a matter of fact, like one of the people in the office, the very first day I started said, "So what are the things that drive you? What are your kind of key words that we should be aware of as we begin to work with you?" And for me, the three words are curiosity, community, and collaboration. And so that applies to my relationship with the board, that it is collaborative and community-based. It applies to how we work as a team within SPAC, and it applies to how we want to work with the community, because, you know, collaborating with all these amazing people, whether it's Teddy Foster at UPH or it's Elena Richardson at Yaddo or it's this, all the stuff that's going on at Skidmore is phenomenal. I mean, there's so much to be done. And if there's one thing other than fundraising that I really feel is part of my mission and part of that Southerners proselytizing DNA that I have is really sharing this epiphany that I had around Saratoga and how extraordinary it is, what an amazing community and how culturally vibrant it is. And I know that most people outside of the immediate area, whether you want to say Saratoga or the Capital Region, they really don't know the extent of it, neither in Saratoga nor, you know, the extent of the cultural vibrancy in the Capital Region in general, whether it's the enormous transformation of Schenectady around what's happened at Proctor's and, you know, the brilliant Philip Morris, or, you know, I look at the Albany Symphony. I've been such an admirer of David Alan Miller. We go back years. And yes. And he's always amazed me at his, you know, brilliant thinking. And he's been ahead of the curve all along the way in terms of programming and attracting younger audiences.
Well, as the 2,000-year-old man once said, "I'm here and they're not." And he is.
Very good, very good.
No, he's great. Are you a tough boss? Because you came out of the commercial world.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of people working for you. And obviously, always comes the question of what happens when somebody's not cutting it.
I have very high expectations, so I do hold people to a very high standard, but I also am the kind of person who, you know, I always say to people when they're, you know, getting to know me, I don't expect you to have all the answers.
But can you forgive a mistake?
Absolutely. As long as they realize and acknowledge that they made a mistake and they learn from it. Yeah. I mean, I make mistakes every day myself. I think that, you know, everybody makes mistakes. So you have to, as a leader, you have to, you know, acknowledge and let go of mistakes, particularly if they're new mistakes made under a new, you know, a new leadership, a new system of doing things. But the real question is, are you able to accept responsibility? Are you able to acknowledge that you made the mistake? Are you able to learn from your mistake? If you make the same mistake more than twice, then we might have a problem.
I'm running out of time here. And I guess, Elizabeth Sobel, I wanted to ask you really quickly, have you ever had to fire anybody?
Yes.
Is that the hardest thing in the world?
Yes.
It's right up there, isn't it?
Yes. I can't think of anything worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Been there, done
hopefully,
it.
Hopefully I won't have to do that. I've got a great team of people.
Hopefully, indeed, you will not. In any case, we've been talking with Elizabeth Sobel, the new president and CEO of Saratoga Performing Arts Center, or SPAC. You can find out much more at www.spac.org. Elizabeth Sobel, you are such a pleasure to talk to. You know, you are what we call an easy interview. I don't have to do anything. Thanks so much for joining us today. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm a huge fan of yours, and I listen to WAMC every morning religiously.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.